from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us, clicking the subscribe button and telling about us to a friend or coworker. This is episode number 29, recorded on Thursday, December 18th. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me, he has been patient with Janet Yellen for a considerable time, for keeping the term considerable time, Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great. For a change, we didn't get the Yellen yawn, but we got some excitement during her press conference.
Yeah, we got some exciting news from the FOMC. Well, I don't know how exciting it is. We'll break it down very soon. So, of course, today we're going to review the recent statement from the FOMC, press conference, economic outlooks, everything, all the works. An update about oil and its relation to leading currencies, review of the latest news from Russia, and an update on S&P and RBA policies. But first, the FOMC. So, the big change, considerable time, has been omitted? Well,
Sort of omitted.
So, take us through it, Yochai.
Well, they said that considerable time refers to the past event, to quantitative easing, and that has finished. So they changed it to patient. So it's just sort of a technical thing. Basically, it's a continuity. They did actually mention the considerable time with the patients in the same statement, in the same FOMC statement. But anyway, that's quite neutral. So we got more of the same in these specific words.
So the change was, as I quoted now, based on its current estimates, the committee judges that it can be patient in the beginning to normalize the stance of monetary policy. So this was the big change when it comes to omitting the considerable time. So you say it's pretty neutral. It didn't bring up too much change because they said, okay, it's going to be, we're going to start normalization, we'll be patient, but it will be, it is very close to considerable time, right?
Yeah, I mean, they wanted to maintain a balance. On one hand, they knew that markets are looking at these words, so by removing it, it would be sort of hawkish. So they balanced it with the patience, sort of watching inflation also quite closely. And the statement was balanced in general. There were a few bullish things, a repeat of the solid job gains and diminishing underutilization of labor. That's a repeat of the last statement. And they did acknowledge falling inflation, but the long-term surveys remain stable. So sort of leaning to bullish or balance there as well. They did raise the growth forecasts and lowered the employment forecasts. But on the other hand, they see the average of the interest rate at the end of 2015 standing at 1.125 and not 1.375 like in the previous dot chart back in September. So that's a bit dovish. All in all, three dissents from the statement. There was one dove, one honk, and one sort of neutral. So it's also quite neutral. So we had a statement that was neutral.
Oh, okay. So eventually, even though we had we expected that if they'll omit the term considerable time and there'll be another shift toward the hawkish side of the Fed, will be a little bit more construed as if the Fed is taking one step closer to raising rates. But you say on the other hand, it was a little bit more balanced because there were several dissenters. They had a lot more of a patient kind of tone. Literally, when it comes to the word patience, it was all over it. And
right.
We should also, as you said, the median outlook was reduced.
Right.
There was also other things that were a little bit more dovish, as you said, a little bit more hawkish. Like one more member turned to a rate, thinks that the rate will be in 2015. So now it's 15 members,
right,
not 14. But that's not much to lean on to. So in all, you say it was pretty neutral.
Yeah.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah. So the reaction was that markets saw this. Okay, they removed considerable time, but they hedged it quite well, so the dollar weakened and stocks went up. It was sort of some kind of a relief. But the fate of the dollar changed when Yellen began speaking just 30 minutes later.
Oh, okay. So then the real fireworks started off when Yellen started her press conference. So
yeah.
What were the main points that you took from her press conference?
Well, first of all, there was a clear message that rates will rise in 2015. So she removed the doubts that there were in markets that because of lower inflation or worries or natural dovishness, they would refrain from doing that. And perhaps more important, they did refer to the oil price, which we'll talk about later on. She did acknowledge that the falling oil prices, of course, hits headline inflation. We've seen that yesterday, and that it could even reach the core. But she did use the word transitory. This is a word that the Fed used also in the past when oil prices were rising. So sort of she dismissed the rise in oil prices and even went further to say that the fall in oil is a net positive for the US economy.
Okay, so wait, stop the phone right now. So on the one hand, you say that, okay, oil prices going down is good for the economy, and I agree with that. That's pretty, okay, that's pretty straightforward, not too earth-shattering. But on the other hand, you say that, she says that it couldn't have much of a adverse impact on the core inflation. When you look at oil prices, and you look at the inflation, and you look on the core inflation over long periods of time, you see that all of them are related in some sorts. Of course, oil and inflation, but also inflation and core inflation, they are also very much related. So I think that if you will see inflation going down because of oil, you also see some reaction from the core inflation. And I think you also, when you look at the Fed's outlook, they've also revised down the core PCE, not only the PCE itself.
Yeah, she did acknowledge that. But on one hand, okay, it could reach core prices, of course. You feel the price of oil in anything you buy because it's transported. The general picture of the US economy is, well, it's doing quite well. Employment is falling. Even wages are beginning to rise. So if consumers have more money in their pockets, they'll just buy more stuff with that. And I think that's the message we can deduct from what you said.
Okay, so it'll be a little bit more that on the one hand, falling prices will also have some adverse impact on core PC, core inflation. But on the other hand, because there's more transactions, people will consume more, and the economy will have some positive impact from falling oil prices. It will have some positive impact on the core inflation, if you will. So that's right. Like one thing will balance it out. Okay,
right.
Let's assume that's okay.
So yeah, so circling back to the rates.
yeah, okay.
So she did say that the rates will stay, unchanged at least for the next couple of meetings. The word couple in English can be understood as two or a few. And she corrected one reporter and insisted that it's the exact two. That was some kind of English lesson and also an amusing moment. Well, amusing for central bank geeks. Anyway, we know now that we're not going to have a rate hike in March, like I mentioned before, not in January. But she did say every meeting is a live meeting, so even in April, when there is no press conference, we could still have the first rate hike. I believe that even though every meeting is a live meeting, this such a historic move, we'll probably have to wait for June when there is a press conference. That's my baseline assumption. I think it's the market is circling towards that as well.
Okay. And by the way, because the median outlook for Fed rate by the end of December 2015 was revised down, the median at least, we can also take from that when the rate is expected to be a little bit lower by the end of 2015, maybe the rate hike will start at a much more into the future, or it could be that we'll see the rate hike one even after the first one commence will be at a much slower pace. So this is another thing that we could take from the change in the outlook.
Yeah, I think we'll have first rate hike in June from 0 to 25 basis points to exactly 25 basis points. It'll be a bit symbolic, but still a historic move. And then a 25 basis point hike in every meeting until the end of the year, reaching 125 at December, which is, well, just around the median of 1.125. So, but the main message, if we take one step back from this meeting, is that policy will stay accommodative. That means, for example, that the Federal Reserve will continue reinvesting the proceeds from bonds, from maturing bonds, in its huge $4.5 trillion portfolio. And that everything is data dependent.
I think that's always the message that the Fed wanted to, and this is why maybe they had such a convoluted wording for the recent statement, because they do want people will interpret that they take out considerable time to be something that, oh, now it's going to be an automatic raise, they're going to raise rates very automatically in next couple of meetings or so, in next two or three meetings they'll raise rates automatically. They always want to circle back to, okay, it will be data dependent, 2%. If things will go as planned, if nothing will change, then we'll raise rates. How do you like the wording? Do you also found it a little bit more too complex and maybe...
Yeah, the statement was a bit confusing. So they did say patience, but they did mention the previous considerable time. But I think the press conference was clearer. She used a relatively simple language, making it clear that things are data dependent, making it clear that rates will rise, having a clear opinion about oil.
How about the dissenters? That we had three this time. I think it's been a while since we had like three dissenters, no? In the...
Yeah, I can't remember that.
And we had from both sides of the aisle, if you will, doves and hawks. Yeah, how do you interpret that? What do you make out of that?
I think that sort of twisted, convoluted, complex statement triggered these dissents. But I'll just mention that Richard Fisher, which is a hawk, he retires in March, and he doesn't vote next year. Naranya Kuchulokota, who is a dove, he's going to retire in 2016, but anyway, he doesn't vote next year. And I think that also Plasser doesn't vote next year. So I believe that in the next rate hike, in the next rate decision in January, we'll have a more... United Fed.
Okay, so it'll be a little bit more to the dovish side. Do you think that this Fed is a little bit more leaning dove or leaning hawk? Because now they're leaning, obviously, if you only examine by their recent moves of the past year, then obviously there are more hawks, but I think in general there are more, a little bit more doves. That's at least what Yellen is considered, no?
Yeah, the Fed is dovish in general, but this year in 2014 we had a few hawkish voting members. On balance, after the change in the voting rotation in 2015, the voting members, the 10 members, will be more dovish. That's why I think another reason to wait for the first rate hike to... We'll have to wait for that in June and not in April. That's just another ingredient in the mix.
All right, okay. So I think we covered it from six ways to Sunday or whatever the term is. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that. Okay, so we covered that. Let's turn to the other big news that we had was, of course, the ongoing fall in oil prices. That has been on the news in the past couple of months. Oil is now, we're talking today on Thursday, so it went a little bit up, but still around $56 has been gone down. It has gone down only a couple of months ago. It was in $97, so almost $40 drop. And some even estimate it'll go down to $40. So where do you stand on oil? Is it more of a supply? It's more demand? It's more of the US dollar? What's your take on the recent fall in oil prices?
Well, as I've learned from you in previous shows, it's both things. I'll just make a quick repeat. OPEC is not following its own quotas. U.S. shale oil production is rising and rising. That's the supply side. The demand side is that the world is sort of slowing down, or growth is slowing down. That's according to the IMF and other organizations. And the final blow came from OPEC, November 27th, with the Thanksgiving blow that they gave to oil prices by deciding not to cut production, not to have any more emergency meetings, but just, well, to show the American shale industry that they mean business. So that was the most recent blow. And since then, we had a few comments from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, and they all seem very calm on oil prices. They don't plan to have any emergency meeting, and they do even explicitly refer to the U.S. shale, the fracking industry, and they will sort of, they're fighting back.
Yeah, and there's that, and when you look at OPEC members, some of them are in pretty dire straits, and I'm talking about your money for nothing and your chicks for free kind of dire straits. We're talking about Iran, we call about Venezuela, they're also... They're not happy with the current situation, but because they are part of OPEC and because they've already agreed to keep the... Well, I don't know how much they agreed, but that was what we got from the OPEC summit a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks back.
Yeah, they were outvoted. Yeah,
yeah, they were outvoted, and that's the way it is. And for now, for Venezuela, the situation is pretty dire. They're, according to recent news, they're at 91% default odds. It's not looking good for this country.
I think the regime is set to collapse there next year.
And even though you look at their debt, it's not terrible, but it's because they are pretty much heavily rely on oil. When you look at the debt levels, they've gone substantially up in recent years. Don't get me wrong. Their debt to GDP has gone up from 26% back in 2009 to around 50% in 2014. So the debt level has nearly doubled, and it's still not as if you look at the US, but Venezuela is certainly not the US, and they have they're staring at default, and they're rambling around to get more loans. They recently got some from China. They provide a little bit credit for this country, and the current low rates are not good for this country. The same goes to Iran also. Even though it's the world's fourth largest proven crude oil reserves, and it's it has over 2.7 million barrels per day that it produces, one of the largest in the world, still they are also in a pretty bad shape, and when you add to that they also had some sanctions on them started in the end of 2011 and summer 2012 for the US and the European Union. These also some sanctions that had some substantial adverse effect on them selling oil.
And what about US shale, or what about the high cost production over there? Are we already seeing signs that they're struggling?
Well, for now, we don't see it. We'll have to look for the upcoming financial reports, the earnings reports for the fourth quarter, to see if there's any change. In any case, when it comes to oil production, the changes in supply and also for demand, they don't come up right pretty soon. They take a long time, and it'll have to probably wait until the first half of 2015, around June, July, something like that, maybe, before we'll see some substantial impact on the major oil producers in the US, and whether or not they'll start to maybe produce less or maybe taper down the production or more.
Yeah, at least stop investment in more high-cost projects, yeah.
Exactly, we'll have to see that also in the earnings report fourth quarter, whether or not they'll revise their capital expenditures for next year and for the coming quarters. So this is also pretty interesting, but we'll have to wait until March to see what will happen. And by then, we'll probably know a lot more about where the production is heading. There's that, but I will point out, because I had a recent debate with a friend of mine, I have a lot of debates for some reason in recent months, and this debate was how to go long on oil. Because he believes that oil will go up eventually, and
right, it'll self-correct.
Yeah, so even if it will go down to $40, for instance, let's it's not too out there.
Yeah, I see $40 as a bottom. I think it'll stop just above there, but
okay, so if it goes to $40, Yochai, how do you actually go long on oil? He tried to go long with USO, United States Oil. This is the ETF that follows oil by buying each month short-term futures from month to month. Is that the way to go? Now, the thing is that, as we talked about in the before, you remember, there is also the matter of contango in the futures market.
Right. Contango and backwardation.
Exactly, sir. And contango. Even at we talked about last time on UNG, which is follows the ETF that follows natural gas. But the same goes to oil. If you were to look, and I wanted to show him very clearly how it is. And if you were to look at a US oil and WTI, it's back in 2008, you were clairvoyant, you want to go long on oil back in December when it was around $40, and keep it until December of 2010, 2 years, until it reached $90. That would have doubled your money, right?
Yeah.
But in effect, if you had invested in USO over the same period from December 2008, until December 2010, actually the price nearly didn't change when it comes to that. It went up from the 31st of December 2008, it was $35, and this December 31st 2010 was $39. So it barely rose by only roughly 9%, while for this exact same period, oil went from 44.6 to 91.4. It doubled the money, but USO barely did anything. And that's mainly from contango. If someone is considering going long on oil because they say, oh man, when it goes to $40, I'm all in on oil. If someone does that, then keep in mind, USO is not the way to go, because if you're going it for the long haul, I'm not talking about for 4 or 5 months. For 4 or 5 months, it probably will be okay. The contango probably won't have much of an adverse impact. But if you go for the long haul for a couple of years, because you say, oh, it could take a while till oil prices come back to the $80, $90 price range, then USO, I don't think is the way to go.
Interesting. So that's... yeah, great practical advice for those trading oil, and I think many more people are trading oil nowadays with all the movements we're seeing there.
Interesting signs for oil traders, so that's that. And oil also had a very adverse impact on another big country. We're talking about Russia, of course, that heavily relies on oil. So, Yochai, where do we stand with Russia? Where do you stand with oil and Russia? Take us through it. What happened and where are we heading from here?
Yeah, well, Russia is the world's largest country in terms of territory, and it's very reliant on oil. So we had the ruble tracking oil prices very, very closely, no matter what other economic policies were made by the government or by the central bank. We just had ruble going up and down with oil prices. However, at the beginning of this week, we saw the ruble tumbling down faster than oil, basically losing it. So in the night between Monday and Tuesday, 1 a.m. Moscow time, the central bank, just 2 days after already raising the rates in a scheduled meeting, had an emergency meeting and lifted interest rates from 10.5 to 17%. So at the beginning it did help strengthen the ruble, but eventually the market saw this as a panic move.
These Russians really mean business, huh? When they see the going get tough, they are getting tougher, right? This kind of maneuver isn't something that is too common when we see other struggling economies. Well, that's also debatable whether or not Russia is in such dire straits, because even though you're right that they're not in good shape by all counts, they're still, when you look at, for instance, their debt isn't too high. It's roughly 13%, and they have ample assets, and they continue to probably expand their production of oil and natural gas. But the question is, how fragile is Russia right now?
Well, Russia isn't that fragile. The regime there is quite strong. They do have lots of foreign reserves, and people there are used to trouble, so they're quite tough. We had a currency crisis in 1998, and then we had the global financial crisis that also caused some panic in 2008. So this time we have seen people buying iPhones, furniture, jewelry, at least not rushing into banks. We did see some capital flight, but it's so far a little bit limited. I mean, it's not full panic mode. So we had the dollar ruble rising as high as 80. It touched 80 and then it fell. It's around 60 last time I looked. So it's still a weak currency that could impact inflation and deepen the recession that is already projected for Russia. But if we see things stabilizing just a bit, suffering will not be that bad. But it all depends on confidence, how much money is flying into Swiss bank accounts.
Well, of course, talk about again Russia and their developments, but let's do a little bit of quick segments on the recent news from SNB. They lowered their rates again.
Yeah, the Swiss National Bank meets only once every 3 months and didn't change its policy since the big move back in September 2011. Basically, the interest rate is zero, and they pegged the Swiss franc to the euro. But recently, there's been a lot of pressure from two angles. One is what we talked about, Russian money flying into Swiss bank accounts, lifting the value of the Euro-Swiss and triggering more and more intervention by the Swiss National Bank to defend the 120 floor. We've seen it very, very close, 120.08 and things like that. And another thing is that the ECB is set to announce QE in January. We had another hint yesterday from an ECB member that I'll probably butcher his name, Benoit Couer, or something like that. He didn't say too much of news, but he did say that they're ready to act quite soon, and it hit the euro, and it seems like the Swiss National Bank tried to preempt a move by the ECB, as well as defend against Russian inflows. So what they did, they had an emergency meeting just a few weeks after the previous meeting, and they decided to set a negative deposit rate of 0.25, lower than the ECB's 0.20. So that lifted Euro-Swiss from the floor. After reaching almost 121, we had it sliding back to around 120.30, 120.40. Of course, initial market reaction is not all that matters. What matters is that people who deposit money into Swiss bank accounts will basically get punished or have to pay to hold these deposits, and hopefully for the Swiss this will deter money from flowing into Switzerland and having them intervene and fight against inflation, and but just send the money elsewhere, like property in London or the United States or wherever.
All right, and turning from this Switzerland, we also conclude our journey, the small world journey, to Australia, and they're also planning their rate cut anytime soon.
Yeah, so Australia is of course a totally different story. The sun is shining there, but we have an interest rate, a positive one of 2.5%, and the RBA had a neutral stance. It always talked about having a strong Aussie and how it's bad for the economy, but in the recent rate decision earlier this month, they upped the rhetoric, saying it needs to go lower. And then just a week later, RBA Governor Glenn Stevens said that he would prefer an exchange rate of 75 cents. So all this put more pressure on the Aussie. It reached, last time I looked, 81 cents, but it's trading between 81 and 82. It's almost every day a new low, a new four-year low. The critical level to watch is 80.66, which was the low level seen in 2010, and of course the round number of 80. Apart from the RBA rhetoric, we've seen GDP growth really slowing down in Q3, and China, Australia's number one trade partner, also slowed down. They had a rate cut beforehand. We had the independent HSBC manufacturing PMI fall back to contraction territory below 50 points at 49.5. All this also, together with the RBA, they don't have a meeting in January because it's summer vacation over there in Australia. But they do have a meeting in February, and some banks in Australia speculate they will cut the rates. I think they'll be a bit cautious with that, especially as they don't intend to use all kinds of macroprudential tools to curb the housing boom, let's call it, not bubble. So they could still keep interest rates relatively high against the housing and cut it carefully. But there is a significant prospect of Australia cutting interest rates in 2015, and it might even result in parity between the Australian and New Zealand dollars. And New Zealand's situation is currently better and looking better looking forward.
And by the way, how do you see oil prices and their tumble with the relation to the Aussie dollar?
It's not that related. Australia exports iron ore, copper, a bit of gold.
So you say oil isn't such a strong component in the Aussie dollar as, for instance, oil is with the Russian ruble, for instance?
No, no. Canada exports a lot of oil, and we've seen the Canadian dollar tumbling down. Also, levels last seen since 2009, around 116.70 was the top. The fall in the Canadian dollar comes despite strong Canadian economy and rising inflation even over there. We've seen other economies such as, a Norwegian one, they cut the rates, they suffer from tumbling oil prices. Australia is not dependent on oil that much, but of course lower oil prices mean lower inflation and higher tendency eventually of the RBA to cut rates. So it's sort of a very indirect impact.
Well, but for Australia, we have to also keep in mind that, okay, oil is one component out of their mix. But if you even look at copper, iron ore, they've also tumbled down in the past year or so. They haven't done well, and they've also had some adverse impact on the Aussie.
Exactly. A great point. Indeed, the fall in commodity prices is also a result of slower demand in China. And it also weighs on the Australian dollar, indeed.
Yeah, okay, cool. Okay, thank you as usual, Johan.
Okay, thank you, Lior.
Yeah, and thank you all for listening. If you like our show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. You can subscribe to the show via Stitcher, email, RSS, or iTunes, whatever suits you fancy. So until next week, this is Lior signing off for Johan, saying have a great week and invest responsibly.
This podcast should be used for educational, research, and informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. There are no guarantees expressed or implied of future positive returns in regard to the subject matter contained herein. Understand the risks inherent in investing before making the decision to invest or consult an investment professional for more information. A reasonable due diligence has been performed in regards to the information in this podcast. However, the hosts and guests of this podcast expressly disclaim any liability for accidental omissions of information or errors in fact. For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com. where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.